at Rachel. What have you got? Rachel took a steady-handed draw of her martini, put the glass down, and then composed herself. I spent most of the day at the FO in Westwood with the ASAC, she said. I was treated as a leper at first, but when they started going through the checkable facts of the story I was telling, they started seeing the light. ASAC? Emily asked. She said it the way Rachel had. ASAC. Assistant Special Agent in Charge of the L.A. Field Office, Rachel said. You said his name is Metz? I asked. Matt Metz, Rachel said. Anyway, I already told you that they've linked at least three other cases by cause of death, and then Gwyneth Rice, the only known survivor. Were you able to get the new names? I asked. No, that's what they're holding back to trade with you for pushing the story back, Rachel said. I didn't get them. That's not going to happen, I insisted. We're going to publish tomorrow. Putting out the warning about this guy is more important than any other consideration. You sure that the scoop is not the most important thing to you, Jack? Rachel shot back. Look, we've been over this, I said. It's not our job to help the FBI catch this guy. Our job is to inform the public. Well, you might change your mind when you hear what else I got, Rachel said. Then tell us, Emily said. Okay, I was dealing with this guy Metz, who I knew from when I was an agent, Rachel said. Once they legitimized what I brought them, they started putting together a war room and attacking this from all angles. They found the other cases, and one team was working on that. There's also a case in Santa Fe, where they're going to do an exhumation of the body tomorrow because they think AOD might have been missed at autopsy. How could they miss a broken neck? I asked. Condition of the body, Rachel said. I didn't get the exact details, but it was left out in the mountains and animals got to it. AOD may not have been seen for what it was. Anyway, another team was looking at Hammond and the Dirty Four angle, trying to pull all of that together. Rachel broke off there to take another sip of her martini. And? Emily prompted. Through the site, they ID'd Hammond's partner, Rachel said. At least they think they did. I leaned in over the table. This was getting good. Who is he? I asked. His name is Roger Vogel, Rachel said. Get it? Roger Vogel becomes Rogue Vogue in the digital universe? Got it, I said. How did they find him? I think his fingerprints, digital, that is, are all over the site, she said. They brought in a cipher team, and I don't think it was that hard. I didn't get all the details, but they were able to trace him to a stationary IP address. That was his mistake. He did some maintenance of the site from an unmasked computer, got lazy, and now they know who he is. So, what is the location? I said. Where is he? Cedar Sinai, Rachel said. It looks like the guy works in administration. That's the location of the computer he used. At first I felt a jolt of excitement at the prospect of confronting Vogel before the FBI grabbed him. But then, the reality hit me. Cedar Sinai Medical Center was a massive, high-security complex that covered five entire blocks in Beverly Hills. It might be impossible to get to him. Are they picking him up? I asked. Not yet, Rachel said. They're thinking that having him loose might work to their advantage. As bait for the Shrike, Emily said. Exactly, Rachel said. It's clear he wanted to take Vogel out and made a mistake with the guy up in Northridge, so he may try again. So, I said, thinking out loud, if the Bureau is watching this guy, there is nothing to stop us from going in there and confronting him. Have they traced him to his home or other locations? No, Rachel said. Thanks to you giving Vogel the warning about the Shrike, he's taking all precautions. They had a loose tail on him and lost him after he left work. That's not good, Emily said. But here's the thing, Rachel said. He's a smoker. He is taking precautions, but he still has to go outside to smoke. I saw surveillance photos of him at a smoker's bench outside the building. There was a street sign in the background. It said George Burns Road. That goes right through the middle of the complex. I looked across the table at Emily. We both knew exactly what we were going to do. We're going to be there tomorrow, I said. We'll get him when he comes out to smoke. Emily turned to Rachel. Would you recognize this guy off the surveillance photo you saw? She asked. If you saw him at the bench, I mean?
I think so, Rachel said.
Yes. Okay, I said. Then we'll need you to be there too. If I do that, it will burn me with the Bureau, Rachel said. I'll be like you two, on the outside looking in.
Okay. We'll have to figure out a plan for that, I said.
I grabbed my glass and finished off my drink. We had the rough outlines of a plan, and I was good to go. Chapter 39. The Cedars-Sinai Medical Center was a cluster of tall glass buildings and parking garages, crowded together on a five-block parcel, but still segregated by the grid of city streets passing through those blocks. At the office that morning, we used the Street View feature of Google Maps to locate the smoker's bench Rachel had seen in the FBI surveillance photo. It was at the corner of Alden Drive and George Burns Road, an intersection almost dead center in the medical complex. It was apparently centrally located to serve patients, visitors, and employees from all buildings in the complex. It consisted of two benches facing each other across a fountain in a landscaped strip that ran alongside an eight-story parking garage. There were pedestal ashtrays at the ends of each of the benches. We finalized a plan and headed there from the office at 8 a.m., hoping to be in place before Roger Vogel would go out for his first smoking break. We watched the smoking benches from two angles. Emily and I were in the nearby ER waiting room, where the windows gave us a full-on ground-level view of the benches, but no view of the administration building. Rachel was on the third level of the parking garage, because it gave a commanding view of the benches plus the entrance of the administration building. She would be able to alert us when Vogel emerged and headed to the benches to smoke. Her position also kept her out of the view of the FBI. Using the angles she remembered from the surveillance photo she had seen the day before, she had pinpointed the FBI observation post in a medical office building across the street from administration. Emily Atwater was a lapsed smoker, meaning she had cut back from a pack-a-day habit to a pack-a-week dalliance, and primarily indulged herself during off-work hours. I remember the ash can outside the second-floor exit at her apartment building. At regular intervals, she went out to the benches to smoke a cigarette, hoping that she would be in place when Vogel showed up to indulge his own habit. I had not smoked since I had moved to California, but I had a prop pack of cigarettes in my shirt pocket as well, with the intention of going to the benches and using them when Vogel finally appeared. The morning passed slowly, with no sighting of Vogel. Meanwhile, the benches were a popular spot for other employees, visitors, and patients alike. One patient even walked her mobile IV pole and drip bag out to the spot for a smoke. I kept a steady text chain going with Rachel and included Emily when she was at one of the benches. That was where she was at 10:45 when I sent out a group missive suggesting we were wasting our time. I said Vogel had probably been spooked by the conversation I'd had with him the day before and blown town. After sending it, I got distracted by a man who had entered the ER with blood on his face and demanded to be attended to immediately. He threw a clipboard he had been handed onto the floor and yelled that he had no insurance but needed help. A security guard was moving toward him when I heard my text chime go off and pulled my phone. The text was from Rachel. He just walked out of administration, cigarettes in hand. The text had gone to both Emily and me. I checked on Emily through the window and saw her sitting on one of the benches looking at her phone. She had gotten the alert.
I headed out through the automatic doors and toward the smoking benches. As I approached, I saw a man standing by the benches. Emily was on one bench smoking, and another woman was on the other. Vogel, if it was Vogel, was apparently intimidated about sharing one of the benches with the women. This was problematic. I didn't want him standing when we identified ourselves as journalists. It would be easier for him to walk away from us. I saw him light a cigarette with a flip lighter. I started to remove the prop pack of smokes from my shirt pocket. I saw Emily pretending to read a text, but I knew she was opening her phone's recording app. Just as I got there, the interloping smoker stubbed out her cigarette in the ashtray and left the butt behind. She got up and walked back toward the ER. I saw Vogel take her place on the empty bench. Our plan was going to work out. As far as I could tell, Vogel never looked at Emily or acknowledged her in any way. When I got to the spot, I put a cigarette in my mouth and then patted the pocket of my shirt as if looking for matches or a lighter. I found none and looked at Vogel. "Can I borrow a light?" I asked. He looked up, and I gestured with my unlit cigarette. Without saying a word, he reached into his pocket and handed me his lighter. I studied his face as he reached the lighter out to me. I saw a look of recognition. "Thanks," I said quickly. "You're Vogel, right?" Vogel looked around, and then back at me. "Yeah," he said. "Are you an admin?" Identity confirmed. We had the right guy. I threw a quick glance at Emily and saw that her phone had been put down on her bench and angled toward Vogel. We were recording. "No, wait a minute," Vogel said. You're the reporter." Now I was surprised. How did he know? "What?" I said. "What reporter?" "I saw you in court," he said. "It's you. We talked yesterday. How the hell did you... Are you trying to get me killed?" He threw his cigarette down and jumped up from the bench. He started to head back toward the administration building. I raised my hands as if to stop him. Wait a minute. I just want to talk." Vogel hesitated. "About what?" "You said you know who the Shrike is. We need to stop him. You..." He pushed by me. "You need to talk to us," Emily called. Vogel's eyes darted toward her as he realized she was with me and he was being tag-teamed. "Help us catch him," I said, "and then you'll be safe too." "We're your best chance," Emily said. "Talk to us. We can help you." We had rehearsed what we would say on the ride over from the office, but the script, as it was, did not go much further than what we had just said. Vogel kept walking, yelling back at us as he went. "I told you, none of this was supposed to happen. I'm not responsible for what that crazy person is doing. Just back the fuck off." He started across George Burns Road. "You just wanted the women to be fucked over, not killed, right?" Emily called. "Very noble of you." She was standing now. Vogel pirouetted and strode back to us. He bent slightly to get right into Emily's face. I moved in closer in case he made a further move toward her. "What we did was no different from any dating service out there," he said. "We match people with what they were looking for, supply and demand. That's it." "Except the women didn't know they were part of that equation," Emily pressed. "Did they?" "That didn't matter," Vogel said. "They're all whores anyway, and..." He stopped as his eyes found the cell phone Emily held up in front of her body. "You're recording this?" he shrieked. He turned to me. "I told you! I want no part of this story!" he yelled. "You can't use my name!" "But you are the story," I said. "You and Hammond and what you're responsible for." "No!" Vogel cried. "This bullshit is gonna get me killed!" He turned again toward the street and headed to the crosswalk. "Wait, you want your lighter?" I called after him. I held it up in my hand. He turned back to me, but didn't slow down as he stepped into the street. "Keep!" Before he could say the next word, a car swooshed by and caught him in the crosswalk. It was a black Tesla with windows tinted so dark It could have been driverless, and I would not have been able to tell. The force of the collision at the knees threw Vogel forward into the intersection, and then I saw his body swallowed up by the silent car as it ran over him. The Tesla bounced as it went over Vogel. His body was then dragged underneath it into the middle of the intersection before the car could finally break free of it. I heard Emily scream behind me, but there was no sound from Vogel. He was as silent as the car that took him under. Once free of the body, the Tesla hit top takeoff speed and screamed across the intersection and down George Burns Road to 3rd Street. I saw the car turn left on a yellow light and disappear. Several people ran to the crumpled and bloodied body in the intersection. It was, after all, a medical center. Two men in seafoam green scrubs were the first to get to Vogel, and I saw that one was physically repelled by what he saw. There were drag marks and blood on the street. I checked on Emily, who was standing next to the bench she had occupied, her hand to her throat, as she gazed in horror at the activity in the intersection. I then turned and joined the scrum that was gathering around Roger Vogel's unmoving body. I looked over the shoulder of one of the men in scrubs and saw that half of Vogel's face was missing. It had literally disintegrated while he had been dragged face down under the car. Vogel's head was also misshapen, and I was sure that his skull had been crushed. "Is he alive?" I asked. No one answered. I saw that one of the men had a cell phone up to his ear and was making a call. "This is Dr. Bernstein," he said calmly. "I need a rescue ambulance to the intersection right outside ER Alden and George Burns. Somebody got hit by a car out here. We have major head and neck trauma. We'll need a backboard to move him, and we need it now." I became aware of the sound of sirens nearby, but still outside the medical complex. I hoped that those were FBI sirens, and they were descending on the Shrike, running him to ground in his silent killing machine. My cell phone buzzed, and it was Rachel. "Jack, is he dead?" I turned and looked up at the garage. I saw her standing at the 3rd-floor balustrade, cell phone to her ear. "They're saying he's still alive." What the fuck happened? It was a Tesla. It was the Shrike. Where's the FBI? I thought they were watching this guy. I don't know. They were. Did you get a plate? No, it was too fast, unexpected. I'm coming down. She disconnected, and I put my phone away. I leaned back over the men trying to help Vogel. I then heard Dr. Bernstein speak to the other man in scrubs. "He's gone. I'm calling it. 10:58. I'll call off the truck. We need to leave him here for the police." Bernstein pulled his phone again, and I saw Rachel heading toward me. She was talking on her phone. She disconnected when she got to me. "That was Metz," she said. "He got away."
The Shrike. Chapter 40. He knew it was more than likely an FBI trap, but he also knew they would not be prepared for his move. They would refer to the profiles and programs they relied on like religion when it came to understanding and catching men like him. They would expect him to do what he had done before, follow his quarry and attack with stealth. And that was their mistake. Using his phone, he had watched the two reporters on the hospital's own security cameras and knew they were staking out some kind of rendezvous spot. When he was sure they had identified the target for him, he moved quickly and boldly. Now he was gone like a blur, and he was sure they were scrambling in his wake. But they were too late. He was pleased with himself. The last connection between him and the site and the list was surely dead, and now it was time for him to fly south for the winter, maybe change plumage and prepare. He would then come back to finish things when it was least expected. He drove the Tesla up the ramp and into the parking garage of the Beverly Center. He drove all the way up to the 4th level. There were not many cars up here, and he suspected that the mall tended to be more crowded in the later hours of the day. He parked at the southeast corner. Through the decorative steel grating that encased the structure, he could see down to La Cienega Boulevard. He saw flashing lights on unmarked cars moving in the traffic. He knew the cars belonged to the feds he had just outwitted and embarrassed. Fuck them. They were searching blind and would never find him. Soon, he heard a helicopter overhead as well. Good luck with that. And good luck to the owner of every black Tesla that was about to get pulled over by feds with their guns out and anger in their eyes. He checked himself in the rearview mirror. He had shaved his head the night before, in case they had managed to get a physical description of him. His scalp had been startling white when he was finished, and he had to rub bronzer from CVS over it. It had stained his pillow while he slept, but it did the trick. It now looked like he had kept the look for years. He liked it, and found himself checking his look in the mirror all morning. He lowered the windows about an inch to let air come in, then killed the engine and opened the door. Before getting out, he took out a matchbook and a pack of cigarettes. He lit a cigarette with a match and drew in deeply, watching the tip glow hot in the rear view. He coughed as the smoke invaded his lungs. That always happened. He then folded the matchbook around the middle of the cigarette and put the improvised fire starter down on the center console. He adjusted it so the cigarette was tilted slightly downward and would continue to burn up toward the matches. With any luck, the matches wouldn't be necessary, and the cigarette would do the job. He got out of the car, closed the driver's door, and quickly moved to the front of the car. He checked the front bumper and the plastic skirt below it to see if there was any blood or debris. He saw nothing and bent down to check beneath. He saw blood dripping onto the concrete like oil from the engine of a gas-powered car. He smiled. He thought that was ironic. He moved back to the side of the car and opened the rear passenger door. There was the natural gas canister he had removed from Hammond's poolside barbecue on the back seat. He had cut the rubber hose attachment 3 inches from the coupling and then bled off most of the contents. He did not want a large explosion, just enough to do what was needed. Now, as he opened the valve, he heard the hiss of the remaining gas escaping into the car. He stepped back, peeled off his gloves, and threw them into the car. The Tesla had served him well. He would miss it. He closed the car door with his elbow and started walking toward the escalator that would take him down to the street. On the second escalator down, he heard the unmistakable thump of the explosion ignite inside the Tesla. Not enough to blow out the windows, but good enough to engulf the inside of the car and burn away every trace of its final user. He was confident they would never know who he was. The car had been stolen in Miami, and the current plates on it were from a duplicate Tesla in the long-term parking lot at LAX. They might have a picture of him, but they would never know his name. He had taken too many precautions. He opened the Uber app on his phone and ordered a pickup on the La Cienega side of the mall. In the destination prompt, he typed LAX. The app told him his driver, Ahmet, was on his way and that he would be at the airport in 55 minutes. That was time enough to decide where to go.
The first story. FBI DNA killer on the loose. By Emily Atwater and Jack McAvoy. The FBI and Los Angeles police have begun an urgent hunt for a man suspected of killing at least 10 people in a cross-country murder spree that included breaking the necks of 8 young women. The killer, who is known as the Shrike on the internet, targeted the women based on specific profiles from DNA they had provided to a popular genetic analytics site. The victims' genetic profiles were downloaded by the unidentified suspect from a site on the dark web that catered to a clientele of men seeking to take sexual advantage of women. The FBI has scheduled a major news conference tomorrow in Los Angeles to discuss the investigation. This week, the two operators of the site, which was closed down by the FBI today, were murdered by the suspect, authorities said. Marshall Hammond, 31, was found hanged in his Glendale home, where he operated a DNA lab. Roger Vogel, 31, was mowed down in the street in a hit and run just seconds after being confronted by reporters from Fair Warning. A third man was also killed by the suspect earlier when authorities believe he was mistaken for Vogel. Prior to the killing of the three men, seven women in places stretching from Fort Lauderdale to Santa Barbara were brutally murdered by a suspect who used a signature method of breaking the necks of his victims. An eighth woman survived a similar attack, but was rendered quadriplegic by her injuries. The 29-year-old Pasadena woman, whom Fair Warning is not identifying, helped provide investigators with links connecting all of the cases. "This is one of the most vicious serial offenders we have ever encountered," said Matthew Metz, assistant special agent in charge of the FBI's Los Angeles field office. "We're doing all we can to identify him and run him to ground. No one is safe until we get him." The Bureau released a composite sketch of the suspect, as well as a shadowy video of a man believed to be him and taken from a home surveillance camera in Marshall Hammond's neighborhood shortly after his murder. The Bureau missed a chance to apprehend the suspect yesterday when he eluded a surveillance that was placed on Roger Vogel, who worked in the administration offices at Cedars-Sinai's Medical Center. Fair Warning reporters confronted him at a smoker's bench outside the hospital, where he denied any responsibility for the deaths. "None of this was supposed to happen," Vogel said. "I'm not responsible for what that crazy person is doing." Vogel then stepped into a crosswalk at the intersection of Alden Drive and George Burns Road and was immediately hit by a car believed to be driven by the murder suspect. He was dragged under the car for 30 feet and sustained fatal injuries. The car was later located by the FBI in the nearby Beverly Center parking garage, where it had been set on fire in an attempt to destroy any evidence that could lead to the identity of the killer. The shrike came to light after the murder a week ago of Christina Portrero, 44, who was found in her home with a broken neck after last being seen with a man at a bar on the Sunset Strip. Fair Warning began an investigation of the death after learning that Portrero had supplied her DNA to GT23, the popular online genetic analytics company, for hereditary analysis. She had also complained to friends that she had been stalked by a stranger who knew intimate personal details about her. That man is not believed to have been the Shrike, but another customer of the same dark web site, where the Shrike selected his victims according to their DNA makeup. GT23 openly states that selling anonymized DNA to second-tier labs helps it keep costs to consumers low. Customers pay only $23 for a DNA hereditary analysis. Among the labs the company sells DNA to is Orange Nano, a research laboratory in Irvine operated by William Orton, formerly a biochemistry professor at UC Irvine. According to Orange County authorities, Orton left his post 3 years ago to start Orange Nano when he was accused of drugging and raping a student. Orton has vehemently denied the accusations. Hammond was a graduate of UC Irvine and had been a student of Orton's. He later started a private research lab that received hundreds of samples of female DNA from Orange Nano after they were purchased from GT23. The Fair Warning investigation determined that Hammond and Vogel opened a site on the dark web called Dirty 4 more than 2 years ago. Customers of this site paid access fees of $500 annually to download the identities and locations of women whose DNA contained a chromosome pattern known as DRD4, which some genetic researchers have concluded is indicative of risky behaviors, including drug and sex addiction. "They were selling these women out," a source close to the investigation said. "These creepy guys were paying for lists of women they thought they could get an edge with. They could go pretend to meet them in a bar or someplace, and they would be easy marks. It is so sick, and no wonder you end up getting a killer in the mix." The FBI said website records indicated that Dirty 4 had several hundred paying members, many of whom were solicited in online forums catering to incels, men who designate themselves as involuntarily celibate, and other misogynist viewpoints. "This is a horrible day," said Andrea McKay, a Harvard University law professor and recognized expert on ethics in genetic fields. "We have reached the point where the predators now can custom order their victims. The DNA passed on by GT23 was anonymized, but authorities believe that Roger Vogel, a skilled hacker who used the name Rogue Vogue online, infiltrated the company's computers and was able to retrieve the identities of the women whose DNA was sold to Hammond by Orange Nano. One of the Dirty Four users was the Shrike. The FBI believes he used access to the profiles provided on the site to target victims in his murder spree. Agents have identified 11 victims, including the Pasadena woman who survived her attack, and believe there may be more. An exhumation in Santa Fe was scheduled for today and could lead to the determination of a 12th victim. The connection between the female victims is the cause of death or injury. Each of the women suffered a devastating neck break, called atlanto-occipital dislocation. Medical examiners refer to this as internal decapitation, a complete break of the neck bones and spinal cord that occurs when the head is violently twisted more than 90 degrees past normal limits. "This guy is strong," the FBI's Metz said. "We think he literally breaks their necks with his bare hands or in an arm lock maneuver of some kind. It is a horrible and painful way to die." The Shrike takes his online name from a bird that is known as one of nature's most brutal killers. The bird silently stalks its prey, field mice and other small animals, and attacks from behind, gripping its victim in its beak and viciously breaking its neck. The killings and the investigation are sure to impact the quickly growing and multi-billion-dollar genetic analytics industry. A fair warning investigation determined that the industry, which falls under the control of the Federal Food and Drug Administration, is virtually unregulated, as the agency is in the midst of a long-running effort to promulgate rules and regulations for the industry. The strong indication that measures to protect the anonymity of DNA samples have been compromised is sure to send a shockwave through the industry. "This is a game changer," said Jennifer Schwartz, a life sciences professor at UCLA. "The whole industry is based on the principle of anonymity. If that is compromised, then what do you have? A lot of scared people and a whole industry that could start to wobble." The FBI shut down the Dirty Four website and is actively attempting to contact women whose identities were revealed and sold by Hammond and Vogel. Metz said that there are strong indications that the suspect has multiple profiles that he retrieved from Hammond's lab computer after killing him. He said that GT23 and Orange Nano are fully cooperating with that part of the investigation. "That's the priority at this moment," Metz said. "We have to find this guy, of course, but we need to reach all of the unsuspecting women so we can warn and protect them." Metz said it was unclear why Hammond and Vogel were murdered, but that it is likely the two men held the keys to identifying the Shrike. "I think he got wind of the investigation and knew that the only two people who could help identify him were these guys," Metz said. "So they had to go, and they ended up with a dose of their own medicine. There's not a lot of sympathy around here for them, I'll tell you that." Little is known about the relationship between Hammond and Vogel, but it is clear that the two men met at UC Irvine, where they were roommates. Students from that era say the two men may have crossed paths in an informal and unsanctioned group at the school that was involved in digital bullying of female students. "It was a forerunner of these incel groups you are seeing today," said a school official who requested anonymity. "They did all kinds of things to female students, hacked their social media, spread lies and rumors. Some girls left school because of what they did to them, but they always hid their trail. No one could prove anything." Incels, are primarily men who identify themselves as involuntarily celibate and on internet forums blame and disparage women for their romantic problems. In recent years, there's been an uptick of crimes against women attributed to incels. The FBI has listed the groups as a growing concern. The Dirty 4 website appeared to be fueled by similar attitudes and sentiments, Metz said. These guys were women haters and took it to an extreme limit, he said. And now 7 or 8 women are dead and another will never walk again. It's horrible. Meanwhile, authorities fear that the hit-and-run killing of Vogel yesterday may indicate that the Shrike is changing his methods, which could make him more difficult to track. He knows we are onto him, and the best way to avoid the net closing in on him is to either stop the killing or change his routine, Metz said. Unfortunately, this guy has a taste for killing, and I don't see him stopping. We are doing our very best to identify him and take him down. Jack. Chapter 41. 100 days after our first story was posted, the Shrike had still not been identified or captured. In the course of that time, Emily Atwater and I wrote 32 more stories, staying with the investigation and running out in front of the rest of the media that descended like locusts after our first dispatch. Myron Levin negotiated an exclusive partnership with the Los Angeles Times, and most of our stories were carried on the front page above the fold. We covered the expanding investigation and the confirmation of 2 other victims. We posted a full take on William Orton and the rape case he beat. We wrote a piece about Gwyneth Rice, and later covered a fundraiser to help meet her medical expenses. We even wrote stories that captured the sickening online deification of the Shrike by incel groups who celebrated what he had done to his female victims. Myron Levin's concern about losing half his staff came true, but for unexpected reasons. With the Shrike still out there somewhere, Emily grew too fearful that we would become his next targets. As the story started to lose oxygen because of the lack of developments, she decided to leave Fair Warning. We had gotten offers for a book and a podcast. We decided she would take the book deal and I would record the podcast. She moved back to England to an obscure location that even I wasn't privy to. She maintained that it was better that way, because the secrecy meant that I could not be forced to reveal her location to anyone. We communicated almost every day, and I emailed her the raw reporting for the final stories she would write under our names. The 100-day mark of the story was also the endpoint for me at Fair Warning. I had given notice and determined that whatever updates came about, I could report on the podcast. It was a new form of journalism, and I enjoyed going into a sound booth and telling, rather than writing, the story. I called it Murder Beat. Myron was not too upset about having to replace us. He now had a whole drawer full of resumes from journalists who wanted to work for him. The Shrike had put Fair Warning into the public eye big time. Newspapers, websites, and TV news programs across the world had to give us credit for breaking the story. I made guest appearances on CNN, Good Morning America, and The View. 60 Minutes followed our reporting, and The Washington Post profiled Emily and me and even likened our occasionally combative partnership to that of the greatest journalism tag team in history, Woodward and Bernstein. Readership was also up at Fair Warning, and not just on the days we posted a Shrike story. 100 days out, we were starting to see an uptick in donations, too. Myron wasn't on the phone so much, cajoling potential supporters. All was well at Fair Warning. The last story Emily and I wrote was one of the more fulfilling of the 32. It was about the arrest of William Orton for sexual assault. Our stories on Marshall Hammond and Roger Vogel had spurred authorities in Orange County to reopen the investigation of the allegations that Orton had drugged and raped his one-time student. They determined that Hammond had taken the DNA sample submitted by Orton to the sheriff's lab and replaced it with an unknown sample, thereby creating the finding of no match to the swabs in the rape kit. Under the new investigation, another sample was taken from Orton and compared to the material in the rape kit. It was a match, and Orton was arrested and charged. Most of the time, journalism is simply an exercise in reporting on situations and occurrences of public interest. It is rare that it leads to the toppling of a corrupt politician, a change in the law, or the arrest of a rapist. When that does happen, the satisfaction is beyond measure. Our stories on the strike got a warning out to the public and may have saved lives. They also put a rapist in jail. I was proud of what we had accomplished, and proud to call myself a journalist in a time when the profession was constantly under attack. After shaking Myron's hand and leaving the office for the last time, I went to the bar at Mistral to meet Rachel and celebrate the end of one chapter in my life and the start of another. That was the plan, but it didn't work out that way. For 100 days, I had carried a question inside that I could no longer contain. Rachel was already at the bar, sitting at the far left end where it curved to the back wall, and there were two seats we always tried to occupy. The spot gave us privacy and a view of the bar and the restaurant at the same time. There was a couple sitting in the center of the long side and a man by himself at the end opposite Rachel. As with most nights, business started slow and then picked up later on. The French Impressionist was working this night. That was what Rachel had started privately calling Elle, the bartender with a phony French accent. I signaled her over, ordered a martini, and was soon clinking glasses with Rachel. "To new things," Rachel said. "Salancha," I said. "Oh, so now we have an Irish poet to go with the French Impressionist?" "Aye, a deadline poet, formerly, I guess. Now, a podcast poet." My Irish accent wasn't cutting it, so I dropped it and drank half the martini. Liquid courage for the big question I had to ask. "I think Myron might have had a tear in his eye when I said goodbye today," I said. "I'll miss Myron," Rachel said. "We'll see him again," and he agreed to come on the podcast to give updates on the strike stuff. "It'll plug the website." "That's good." I finished my martini, and Elle was quick with another. Rachel and I small-talked while I worked the level down on it. I noticed she had not re-upped her own drink and had even ordered a glass of water. She kept looking down the bar at the man sitting alone at the other end. I had my elbows on the bar and now rubbed my hands together, pushing my fingers back. As my internal alcohol level was rising, my courage was dissipating. I was deciding to let my suspicion go for another night, like the 99 before it. "Are you having second thoughts?" Rachel asked. "No, not at all," I said. "Why? Observation? You're wringing your hands? And you just seem, I don't know, pensive? Preoccupied? Off?" "Well, I have to ask you something I've been meaning to ask you for a while."
"Sure. What?"
"That night at the Greyhound, when you were acting like a source and giving me and Emily all that stuff about Vogel and describing the surveillance photo you saw?"
"I wasn't acting. I was your source, Jack. What's your question?"
"That was a setup, wasn't it? You and the FBI, that guy Metz, you wanted us to lead the strike to Vogel. So you told us."
"What are you talking about, Jack?"
"I just gotta say it. It's what I've been thinking. Just tell me, I can handle it. It was probably your allegiance to the people who kicked you out. Was it some kind of a deal to get back in, or—"
"Jack, shut the fuck up before you once again ruin something good."
"Really? I'm the one who will ruin it? You did this thing with them, and I'm the one who ruins everything? That makes—"
"I don't want to talk about this right now. And stop drinking."
"What are you talking about? I can drink. I can walk home if I've had too much. But I'm not even close to that now. I want you to tell me if this was a setup with you and the FBI."
"I told you it wasn't. And listen, we have a problem here."
"I know. You should have told me. I would have—"
"No, I'm not talking about that. We have a problem right here." Her voice had dropped to an urgent whisper. "What are you talking about?" I asked. "Just play along," she said. She turned and kissed me on the cheek, and then put an arm around my neck and nuzzled in close. Public displays of affection were a rarity with her. I knew something was up. She was either going to bizarre lengths to distract me from my question, or there was something terribly wrong. "That guy across the bar," she whispered in my ear. "Be casual about it." I reached forward for my drink and took a glance down the bar to the man sitting by himself. Nothing about him had seemed suspicious to me. He had a cocktail glass in front of him that was half filled with ice and clear liquid. There was a slice of lime in the glass as well. I turned my stool so I was facing Rachel. We had our hands on each other. "What about him?" I asked. "He came in right after me, and he's still nursing his first drink," she said. "Well, maybe he's pacing himself. You're on your first, too." "That's only because of him. He's been kind of watching us without watching us. Watching me."
"What does that mean?"
"It means he has not looked over here once since he got here, but he's using the mirrors."
There was a large mirror that ran behind the bar and another on the ceiling above it. I could see the man in question in both of them, so that meant he could see us.
"You're sure?" I asked. "Yes," she said. "And look at his shoulders."
I checked. His shoulders were large, and the biceps and neck thick. In the days since the Shrike had come to light, the FBI was pursuing a theory that he was an ex-convict who had built up his body in prison and possibly perfected his neck-breaking move there as well. The investigation had zeroed in on the unsolved murder of an inmate at the Florida State Prison in Stark, whose body was found stuffed behind an individual washing machine in the laundry. His neck was broken so severely that the cause of death was listed as internal decapitation. The case was never solved. Several convicts worked in the prison laundry or had access to it, but the surveillance cameras were fogged over by steam released by the dryers, a problem that had been noted by staff repeatedly but never addressed. For more than a month, the Bureau had been looking at video from prison yard cameras and running down data on every convict who worked in the laundry or could have had access to it on the day of the murder. Agent Metz had told me he was sure that the Shrike had killed the inmate. The murder had occurred 4 years earlier, well before the Shrike killings began, and it fit the pattern attributed to the Shrike starting in Florida.
"Okay," I said, "but wait a minute." I pulled my phone and went into the photo archive. I still had a photo of the artist composite of the Shrike. I opened it and tilted the screen to Rachel.
"Doesn't really look like him," I said.
"I don't put a lot of trust in composites," she said.
"What about Gwyneth saying it was a good match?"
"She was emotional. She wanted it to be a match.
The Unabomber composite was right on.
1 in a million. Plus, the Shrike's composite has been on every TV channel in the country. He would have changed his look. That's a big thing with incels. Plastic surgery. Plus, he's the right age. Mid-30s.
I nodded. "So then what do we do?" I asked.
"Well, first, we act like we don't know he's there," Rachel said, "and I'll see if I can get Metz involved."
She pulled out her phone and opened the camera app. She held the phone out as though she was taking a selfie. We leaned close and smiled at the screen as she took a photo of the man at the other end of the bar. She studied the shot for a moment.
"One more," she said.
We smiled, and she snapped another photo, this time zooming the focus in closer on his face. Luckily, Elle was leaning into a conversation with the couple in the middle, so Rachel got an unobstructed shot. I leaned over to see what she got, and fake laughed as if she had taken a bad photo.
"Delete it," I said. "I look like shit."
"No, I love it," she said. Rachel was editing the real shot, expanding it as much as possible without clarity decay, and then saving it. When she was finished, she texted it to Agent Metz with this message.
This guy is watching us. I think it's him. How do we handle?
We pretended to chat while we waited for a reply.
How would he know to follow you here? I asked.
That's easy, Rachel said. I've been in your stories as well as the podcast. He could have followed me from my office. I came straight here after locking up.
That seemed plausible. But this flies in the face of the profile, I said. The Bureau's profilers all said he was not vengeance-motivated. The story is already out. Why risk coming back to do something to us? It's behavior he hasn't shown before.
I don't know, Jack, Rachel said. Maybe it's something else. You've made a lot of generalized statements about him on the podcast. Maybe you got him mad.
Her phone screen lit up with a return text from Metz. What's your 20? I'll send Agent Amin out in a lift. See if he follows, and we'll lead him into a horseshoe. Rachel sent back a text with the address and asked for an ETA on the lift car. Metz replied that it would be 40 minutes.
Okay, so we have to order another round and then act like neither one of us can drive, Rachel said. We fake a request for a lift and then get in the car with Amin.
What's a horseshoe? I asked.
They'll set up a car trap. We drive in, he follows us. They close the horseshoe behind him, and he's got nowhere to go.
Have you ever done a horseshoe trap before?
Me? No, but I'm sure they have.
Let's hope it works.
Chapter 42. 40 minutes later, we were in the back of the FBI's Lyft minivan, with Agent Amin behind the wheel. He pulled away from Mistral and headed west on Ventura Boulevard.
What's the plan? Rachel asked.
We have the horseshoe set up, Amin said. We just have to see if you have a follower.
Did Metz get a bird up?
Yes, but he had to wait until it was free from another op. It's on the way.
How many cars do we have?
4, including the lift.
That's not enough. He may spot the surveillance and bug out.
It's what we could do on short notice.
Where's the horseshoe?
Tyrone Avenue on the north side of the 101. It dead ends at the river, and it's only 5 minutes away.
I saw Rachel nod in the darkness of the car. It did little to balance the anxiety she was exuding.
At Van Nuys Boulevard, we turned north. I could see the 101 overpass just a few blocks ahead. Rachel pulled her phone and made a call. I only heard her side of it.
Matt, are you running this op?
I knew then that she had called Metz.
Did he leave the restaurant?
She listened, and her next question seemed to confirm that the man at the bar had followed us when we left.
Where's the airship?
She shook her head while listening. She wasn't happy with his answer.
Yes, I hope so.
She disconnected the call, but the tone of her last words indicated she thought Metz was handling it wrong, even though she had contacted the FBI agent less than an hour earlier. We crossed under the freeway and then took an immediate turn east on Riverside Drive. 4 blocks later, Amin put on his right turn signal as we approached Tyrone. Amin was monitoring radio traffic on an earpiece. He got an instruction and passed it on to us.
All right, he's behind us, he said. We are going down to the dead end and stopping. You two stay in the van. No matter what, you stay in the van. That understood?
Got it, I said. Understood, Rachel said. We made the turn. The street was lined on both sides with parked cars and only dimly lit. There were single-family homes on both sides of the street. A block ahead, I could see the 20-foot wall of the raised freeway. The tops of cars and trucks were crossing up there left to right, heading west and out of the city.
This is residential, and it's too dark, Rachel said. Who picked this street?
It was the best we could do on short notice, Amin said.
It'll work.
I turned to look out the back window and saw headlights sweep across the roadway as a car slowly made the turn and followed us onto Tyrone.
There he is, I said.
Rachel glanced back and then forward,
obviously better versed in this maneuver than I was. "Where's the cutoff?" she asked. "Coming up," Amin said. I scanned through all the windows, wondering what the cutoff meant. Just as we passed an opening on our right, I saw the lights of a car backed into a driveway flash on. The car then lurched into the street behind us and stopped dead in front of the tail car, creating a barrier between us and the tail. I watched it all through the back window. Simultaneously, another car pulled from a driveway behind the tail car, boxing it in. I saw agents tumble out of the two passenger side doors of the first car and take cover behind the front of it. I assumed the same happened with the car on the other side of the box. Amin kept driving, putting more distance between us and the takedown operation. "Stop here!" Rachel yelled. "Stop!" Ignoring Rachel, Amin started to bring the van to a slow stop. As we reached the terminus of the street at a fence that enclosed the concrete aqueduct known as the Los Angeles River, Rachel was reaching for the release on the side door before he brought it to a halt. "Stay in the van," Amin said. "Stay in the van!" "Bullshit," Rachel said. "If it's him, I want to see this." She jumped out the door. "God damn it," Amin said. He jumped out next and pointed through his open door at me. "You stay right there," he said. He headed off after Rachel up the street. I waited a beat before deciding that I wasn't going to miss this either. Fuck that. I climbed through the door Rachel had left open. Looking around, I saw Rachel up near the blockade. Amin was right behind her. I moved over to the right sidewalk and started up the street behind the cover of the cars parked along the curb. The horseshoe was now lit by headlights and the spotlight of a helicopter that had swung in from over the freeway. I heard the shouts of men in the street up ahead, rising in urgency. Then I heard one word clearly and repeated by many voices. "Gun!" A volley of shots immediately followed, too many to separate and count, all within 5, maybe 10 seconds. I instinctively ducked behind the line of cars on the curb, but kept moving up the street. The gunfire ended, and I straightened up and kept moving, my eyes scanning now for Rachel to make sure she was safe. I didn't see her anywhere. After an eerie silence, the shouting started again, and I heard the all-clear signal. When I got to the box, I cut between two cars and into the light from above. The man from the bar was face up on the ground, next to the open door of an old Toyota. I saw gunshot wounds on his left hand and arm, his chest, and neck. He was dead, his eyes open, and vacantly staring up at the helicopter above. An agent in an FBI raid jacket was standing 8 feet away, his feet spread on either side of a chrome-plated pistol lying on the ground. When he turned slightly, I saw it was the agent I had met after Roger Vogel had been run over by the Shrike. Metz. And he saw me. "Hey, McAvoy!" he yelled. "Get back! Get the fuck back!" I raised my hands wide to show innocence. Metz signaled to another agent standing nearby. "Get him back to the van!" he ordered. The agent moved toward me. He grabbed me by the arm, but I jerked free and looked at Metz. "Metz, you gotta be kidding!" I yelled. The agent moved in to grab me more aggressively. Metz left his position over the gun and moved toward me, holding his hand up to stop the agent. "I'll handle it," Metz said. "Watch the weapon!" The agent changed direction, and Metz came up to me. He did not touch me, but spread his hands as if to block my view of the man on the ground behind him. "Jack, look, you can't be here," he said. "This is a crime scene." "What happened?" I asked. "Where's Rachel?" "Rachel, I don't know, but Jack, you gotta move back. Let us do our job here, and then we'll talk." "He pulled a gun? Jack, was it him? The Shrike didn't use a gun." "Jack, listen to me. We are not talking about this right now. Let us work the scene, and then we'll talk. Get back on the sidewalk now, or we are going to have a problem. You've been warned." "I'm media. I have a right to be here." You do, but not in the middle of the fucking crime scene. I'm really losing my patience with Jack. We both turned. Rachel was standing between two parked cars behind me. Rachel, get him out now or bail him out later, Metz said. Jack, come on, she said. She waved me to her. I looked back at the dead man on the ground and then turned and walked toward her. She moved between the two cars and up onto the sidewalk. I followed. Did you see the shooting? I asked. I just saw him go down, she said. He had a gun. That's not... I know. We'll get answers, but we have to back off and let them do their thing. This is crazy. 20 minutes ago, the guy was sitting there in the bar right across from us. Now he's dead. I just realized I've got to call Myron. I've got to tell him we have one more story to do. Let's just wait on that, Jack. Let them do their work, and then let's see what Metz says. All right, all right. I raised my hands in surrender, and then I spoke without thinking about the content or consequences of what I said. I'm going to ask him about that day, too. Metz. See if he denies it was a setup. Rachel turned and looked at me. She didn't say anything at first. She just slowly shook her head. You idiot, she said. You did it again. The last story. FBI kills armed man in Shrike takedown. By Myron Levin. An Ohio man, stalking an investigator on the Shrike serial killer case, was cut down in a volley of FBI gunfire in Sherman Oaks last night when he drew a weapon and pointed it at agents who had cornered him, federal authorities said. Robinson Felder, 35, of Dayton, was killed at 8:30 p.m. on Tyrone Avenue, just north of the 101 freeway. Agent Matthew Metz said Felder had been following Rachel Walling, a private investigator who had played a pivotal role 3 months ago in revealing the killing spree of a murder suspect known as the Shrike. Metz said that evidence collected from Felder's car indicated that he was involved in online groups that have idolized the Shrike in the months since his killing spree was revealed. Metz said the evidence, most of which was found on a laptop computer and Felder's online history, excluded him from possibly being the Shrike himself. FBI agents stopped Felder on the dead-end street and ordered him out of his car. Metz said Felder initially complied, but then pulled a gun from his waistband once he had stepped out of his car. Metz said Felder pointed the weapon at agents, provoking fire from several of them. Felder was fatally wounded and died at the scene. In addition to the weapon recovered at the scene, agents found what they called an abduction and torture kit in Felder's car, Metz said. He described the kit as a duffel bag containing zip ties and duct tape, as well as rope, a knife, pliers, and a small acetylene torch. We believe his intentions were to abduct and kill Miss Walling, Metz said. The federal agent said the motive for the killing plan was Walling's part in the Shrike case. Walling, a former FBI profiler, consulted with Fair Warning on its investigation into the deaths of several women across the country who died at the hands of a killer who broke their necks in a brutal manner. The Fair Warning investigation revealed that the women were targeted because of a specific DNA pattern they shared. All had submitted their DNA to GT23. A popular genetic analytics provider. Their anonymized DNA was then sold in the secondary market to a genetic research lab, which in turn provided it to the operators of a dark website that catered to men wishing to hurt and take sexual advantage of women. The website has since been shuttered. The Shrike has not been identified or captured. In the week since the killing spree was revealed by Fair Warning, he has become celebrated in online forums catering to the incel subculture. The male-dominated movement, named for a contraction of involuntary celibate, is characterized online by postings involving misogyny, feelings of entitlement to sex, and the endorsement of violence against women. Several physical attacks on women across the country have been ascribed by authorities to incels.
Metz said that a study of Felder's social media history revealed that in recent weeks he had made several posts on various incel forums praising and revering the Shrike and the violence he committed against women. He ended most of these posts with hashtag they deserved it, according to Metz. We have no doubt that this guy came out here to abduct Miss Walling as some kind of homage to the Shrike, Metz said. We are lucky that she wasn't hurt. Walling declined to comment. It was, in fact, Walling who saved her own life. In a Sherman Oaks restaurant, Walling noticed Felder watching her and acting suspiciously. She contacted the FBI, and a plan was quickly formulated to determine if Felder was stalking her. Under FBI surveillance, Walling left the restaurant and drove to a predetermined spot on Tyrone Avenue. Metz said that Felder followed them in his car and drove into an FBI vehicle trap. When he was told to step out of the car with his hands visible, he complied. But then, for unknown reasons, he reached to his beltline and pulled free a .45 caliber pistol. He was fired upon when he raised the weapon into firing position. He gave us no choice, said Metz, who was on the scene during the shooting but did not fire himself. There were seven other agents on the scene, and four of them fired at Felder. Metz said the shooting will be investigated by the Bureau's Office of Professional Responsibility and the U.S. Attorney's Office. Metz, the assistant special agent in charge of the Los Angeles field office, said he was concerned Felder's activities could inspire others in the incel community to act out in the same way. He said efforts are being made to safeguard Walling and others involved in the Shrike case. Meantime, Metz acknowledged that efforts to identify the Shrike and bring about his arrest continue, but frustrations mount with each passing day. We're not going to be able to breathe easy until this guy is in custody, he said. We need to find him.
Jack. Chapter 43. We gathered at the Sunray Studios on Cahuenga Boulevard to record the last episode of the podcast on the Shrike. The last, that is, until there was some sort of break in the case worthy of a new episode. I had gone through 17 episodes. I had discussed the story from every conceivable angle and had interviewed every person associated with the case who was willing to go on the record and be taped. This even included an interview with Gwyneth Rice in her hospital room, her voice, now an eerie electronic creation manifested from her laptop. This last episode was a heavily promoted live discussion, with as many of the players in the case as I could bring together. The studio had a round table in the recording room. It was Rachel Walling, Metz from the FBI, Detective Ruiz from the Anaheim Police Department, Myron Levin from Fair Warning, and Hervé Gaspar, the lawyer who had represented Jessica Kelly, the victim in the William Orton case. I had never been able to figure out whether Ruiz or Gaspar had been my deep throat source. Both had denied it. But Gaspar had eagerly accepted the invitation to be part of the podcast, while Ruiz had to be cajoled. That tipped my hand toward Gaspar. He relished the secret part he had played in the case. Lastly, we had Emily Atwater on the phone, calling in from her unknown spot in England and ready to answer questions as well. We had calls on hold before the scheduled hour even began. This did not surprise me. The podcast had steadily grown in audience. More than 500,000 people had all